Now, the question of the identity of Jesus, that is, who Jesus really is, has been and continues to be a subject that fascinates people, both Christian and non-Christian alike. I like this recent clipping I found in one of the Saturday newspapers. It's called Global Village, a weekly posting from cyberspace. And apparently each week they print an email that's sort of gone all around the globe with some sort of a humour attached to it. And this one is called, this is on the exact ethnicity and nationality of Jesus. The ethnicity and nationality of Jesus. And it goes like this. Recently at a theological meeting in Rome, scholars had a heated debate on this subject. One by one, they offered their evidence. First, three proofs that Jesus was really Italian. One, he talked with his hands. Two, he had wine with every meal. Three, he used olive oil. Secondly, three proofs that Jesus was black. He called everybody brother. He liked gospel music and he couldn't get a fair trial. Three proofs that Jesus was Jewish. One, he went into his father's business. Two, he lived at home until he was 33. Three, he was sure his mother was a virgin and she was sure he was God. But it finishes by saying, but perhaps the most compelling evidence is that Jesus was a woman. One, he kept trying to get the message across to men who just didn't get it. Two, even when he was dead, he had to get up because there was more work for him to do. And three, and pertinent to tonight's sermon, he had to feed a crowd at a moment's notice with no food. Slightly sacrilegious, perhaps, but a reminder to us of the fascination of many people for this man Jesus, of who he is and what he did even 2,000 years later. And of course, it's right that this is so. For the identity of Jesus is the very foundation of the Christian faith. Get it wrong, and the very fabric of Christianity will unravel before us. It's the most crucial issue of all. Theologian J.I. Packer puts it like this. He writes, "The Christian consensus has always been that just as Scripture is the proper source from which theology should flow, so Christology, that is, the study of who Jesus is, Christology is the true hub around which the wheel of theology revolves and to which its separate spokes must each be correctly anchored if the wheel is not to get bent. All the main distinctives of the Christian creed," he says, "spring from Christian Christology. Alter the Christology, and you alter Christianity itself." Now, this, of course, is what we've been seeing in our studies of Mark's gospel. Mark wants us, the reader, to see who Jesus really is. And he begins his gospel with a declaration of intent, the beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And he ends his gospel with an affirmation of that intent in the words of the most unlikely witness, a Roman centurion. "Surely this man was the Son of God." It's all about the identity of Jesus, and Mark wants us to get it right. And it seems to me that's the main thrust of the passage we're looking at tonight. And if there's a key verse in our passage, let me suggest it's verse 21. Jesus said to his disciples, "Do you still not understand?" Now, if that was the question Jesus was asking his disciples then, it might be that for some of us tonight, it will be the question that Jesus wants to ask us. Do you still, after all I'm showing you, do you still not understand? Well, friends, let's look at our passage. It divides itself naturally, I think, into three sections. Verses 1 to 10, which I call the hungry fed. Verses 11 to 13, the Pharisees rebuked, and verses 14 to 21, the disciples warned. So first of all, the hungry fed, verses 1 to 10. We read, during those days, another large crowd gathered. Since they had nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I have compassion for these people. They have already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them home hungry, they will collapse on the way because some of them have come a long distance. Let me just pause and say it's interesting that unlike us, Jesus had no problem balancing the spiritual needs of people and the physical needs of people. Both went hand in hand with him. Back to verse 4, his disciples answered, but where in this remote place can anyone get enough bread to feed them? Well, how many loaves do you have? Jesus asked. 7, they replied. He told the crowd to sit down on the ground. When he'd taken the 7 loaves and given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people, and they did so. They had a few small fish as well. He gave thanks to them also and told the disciples to distribute them. The people ate and were satisfied. And as one wit said, which of us, when offered a free lunch, would not do the same? Afterwards, the disciples picked up 7 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. About 4,000 men were present, and having sent them away, he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the region of Dalmanutha. Now, I wouldn't be surprised that as that passage was being read, if you had not had a slight sense of deja vu. Haven't I heard all that before? And if that's the case, then you're not the first ones. For many Bible students are puzzled by the remarkable similarity of this feeding with the other feeding in chapter 6, the feeding of the 5,000. Both, if you examine both passages together, both occur in what is called a remote place. Both talk about the compassion of Jesus. Both report Jesus questioning the disciples, how many loaves do you have? And in both we read that the people ate and were satisfied. And because of this similarity, some Bible critics have questioned whether this event is really just a recycled version of the first event. They say, Mark surely cannot be accurate here. Surely he's just doing a cut-and-paste job on his word processor and has pressed the copy button at this particular point. There are too many similarities to take it all seriously. But I think that that is the very point that Mark is actually trying to make. It was similar to the first feeding, but still the disciples failed to get it. And aren't they just like us? It may not be, friends, that we have a crowd to feed, but we have some other crisis. We get sick, we lose our jobs, we're uncertain about the future, and what do? Like the disciples did then, we cry out to the Lord to help us. We don't say, Lord, where in this remote place can we get enough food to feed us? But we may say, where are you, Lord? When are you going to come and save me from this situation? And what does God do? He graciously meets us in our despair and our need is met. And so, having had the need met, we promise to the Lord that we'll always be faithful and grateful and we get on with our life. Then, 18 months later, another crisis hits us. And instead of remembering what happened 18 months before, what do? We panic as if nothing has ever happened like this before. We cry to God, we make the same promises, we don't believe that he can help us, but marvellously and miraculously he does. And the cycle continues. You see, Jesus wanted his disciples, and he wants us to know that he is the great provider for we, his people. He is the very bread of life. And this was a message they needed to hear not just once back then when he fed the 5,000, but like us, time and time again. But Mark wants us to note not just the similarities in the story, but also the dissimilarities between the two feedings. Not just the numbers, there were 5,000 in the first case and 4,000 in the other. Not just the needs, as I've said already, the people's spiritual needs in the first feeding. We read in chapter 6, they were like sheep without a shepherd. And here we read their physical needs. But most importantly, their nationality. For who are these people that Jesus is ministering to, but surely the very same people that Jesus has been ministering to in the previous chapter, namely a group of Gentiles? Remember back at chapter 7, verse 24, look at it there. We read, Jesus left that place and went to the vicinity of Tyre. Now, we don't know why Jesus left his home region of Galilee to go north. Mark chapter 3, verse 6 tells us that the Pharisees and Herodians had begun to plot to kill Jesus. And it seems possibly that with his growing popularity, he'd become even more of a threat to his enemies, and so decided that since his time had not yet come to be delivered up to them, he would go across the border into the Gentile nations to the north. So here he is with his disciples, travelling from Galilee into the north, into the Gentile regions. And remarkably, it's there that he finds faith. Remember 2 weeks ago, a Syrophoenician woman comes to Jesus for the healing of her daughter. She knows Jesus' kingdom is primarily for the Jews, but she believes that it might even extend even to the Gentiles. And then we read, Jesus goes from the north right down to the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee, Gentile territory, the Decapolis. And there we see the friends of a deaf and dumb man bring him to Jesus, for they see in him one who can even make the deaf hear and the dumb speak. And now, as a culmination of what was probably months of travelling and ministering amongst the Gentiles, we find this story of Jesus feeding the Gentiles. So that just as he concluded his mission to the Jews in chapter 6 with the feeding of 5,000 Jews, now we see him at the end of his mission to the Gentiles feeding 4,000 Gentiles. And in brackets, as if to confirm that is the case, in verses 19 to 20, Mark uses a different word for the baskets involved in the feeding. It's in the Greek. You need to know your Greek. In verse 19, he speaks about the kophanos, which was a typical Jewish bread basket that was used in the feeding of the 5,000. And now in verse 20, he speaks of spurus, which is a Gentile type of basket used in the feeding of the 4,000. So, question. Why did Jesus feed the 4,000? Surely it's this, for he wanted to show his disciples that just as he is a man of compassion for his own people, the Jews, so he's also come to have compassion on the Gentiles. He may indeed have come first to the children of Israel, but by his actions he shows he's come not only for the children of Israel, but for others also. Most of us. One commentator puts it like this. They write, Christ wanted his disciples to know that he was not just bread for the Jews, but also bread for the Gentiles, spiritual bread for the pagan world, for you and for me. He once said that man cannot live by bread alone. His disciples needed to know that. There is no life for anyone, Jew or Gentile, apart from Jesus. And friends, let me say, if they needed to understand that, so do we. For isn't it all too easy for us to be blinkered in our understanding of mission and evangelism and to think that we are doing okay when in reality we are barely scratching the surface. If Jesus was willing to minister to those whom his people called the dogs, that is, the outsider, those whom we feel uncomfortable to associate with because they're different from us, then surely we ought to be willing to do the same. Recently, I was at a seminar entitled Postmodernism in the Local Church, and the speaker gave to us this challenge. He said this to us: "It's easy for us to reach out to people who are like us, those at the fringe of the church. But these days, such people are in the minority. Our priority as Christians now is to reach out to the majority, those for whom the church is totally foreign. And if we're going to do that, we will need to take risks. Go to where they are and plant churches which are shaped in relation to them, rather than recreate churches or think that they will come to churches which are shaped in relation to us." And that's a good challenge as we think about next Sunday in our Thanksgiving gift day, trying to support the work of the Clubhouse, which is doing exactly that, trying to form a church and a community shaped exactly to the people who live in the Fitzrovia area. Let's support it if we can. So, the hungry are fed. Now let's move on, verses 11 to 13. The Pharisees rebuffed. Verse 11, the Pharisees came and began to question Jesus. To test him, they asked him for a sign from heaven. He sighed deeply and said, "Why does this generation ask for a miraculous sign? I tell you the truth, no sign will be given to it." Then he left them, got back into the boat, and crossed to the other side. Now, note two things about this encounter. Firstly, the motive of the Pharisees. There it is in verse 11. To test him, we read, they asked for a sign from heaven. That is, these people already have their minds made up about Jesus. It's not as though they're going to him in order to believe in him. For back in chapter 3, Mark tells us the Pharisees have already know what they believe about Jesus. They think that he is demon-possessed. And thus they're simply going in order to trap him. Now, in order for us to understand why they're asking him for a sign from heaven, can I ask you to keep your finger in this page and flick back to page 197 to Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 17 to 22. Deuteronomy chapter 18. Now, in this passage, let me set the context. God is speaking to Moses of a prophet that he will one day raise up for his people. And this is what we read, verses 17 to 22 of Deuteronomy 18. The Lord said to me, "What they say is good. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers. I will put my words in his mouth, and he will tell them everything I command him. If anyone does not listen to my words that the prophet speaks in my name, I myself will call him to account. But a prophet who presumes to speak in my name anything I have not commanded him to say, or a prophet who speaks in the name of other gods, must be put to death." Well, you may say to yourselves, how can we know when a message has not been spoken by the Lord? If what a prophet proclaims in the name of the Lord does not take place or come true, that is a message the Lord has spoken. That prophet has spoken presumptuously. Do not be afraid of him. Now, convinced by their own prejudices that Jesus was not that prophet that Moses was talking about, but rather someone demon-possessed, the Pharisees have decided to come to Jesus, requesting him to make a statement about the future. "Jesus, give us a sign. Make a prediction about something that might appear in the sky or some event that might occur in the future. something that will vindicate to them and to all the people who he really is. That is, in their eyes, a fraud. Why do they ask for the sign? Not that they might believe in him, so that when it does not occur, all will see that Jesus is not of God, and therefore they can put him to death and get rid of him completely. But note the Pharisees' blindness in all of this. For Moses, in that Deuteronomy 18 passage, was speaking of a prophet that one day God would raise up, and he describes that prophet in Deuteronomy 18, verse 18, as a prophet, Moses, just like you. That is, who are the people to expect? Somebody who is going to be a new Moses. Somebody who would speak God's words to the people just as Moses had spoken the words to God's people. Somebody who would feed the people in the desert just as Moses had fed the people in the desert. Someone who would rescue the people from the tyrants that bound them just as Moses had rescued them from Pharaoh. And surely, if the Pharisees had their eyes opened, they would have seen that Jesus, by his very actions and words, had as good as demonstrated that he was that prophet sent by God. But what was their problem? Their minds had already been made up. Like many people today, they may have been asking for a sign, but even if Jesus had given them one, it's unlikely they would have believed in it, for they were asking with the wrong motives. But note, secondly, the response of Jesus to their request. Verse 12, we read, "He sighed deeply," and that word could be translated, "He groaned from the bottom of his heart, for he knew that their minds were closed and what they were up to. And Jesus said, 'Why does this generation ask for a miraculous sign? I tell you the truth, no sign will be given to it.' And then the chilling words, 'Then he left them.'" See, what is Jesus saying here? Surely this: that no amount of proof or demonstration was going to be enough for the Pharisees and others in that generation. In the person of Jesus, they had all they needed to make a right response to God, and they actually didn't need anything else. If they could not believe on the basis of Jesus' person, his works and his words, they would not believe on the basis of anything else that he might do for them. It seems to me that some of us here today, that might be a message that we need to hear. For so often I hear, and I guess many of us all hear, people who say to us, "If only God will do this or that for me, write a message in the sky, heal my mother, help me win the lottery, if he did those things, then I would believe." But Jesus here is telling us that if we won't believe him on the basis of what he's already done, as recorded in the scriptures, then nothing else is going to convince us. He says, "Look at what I've already said and done. You actually don't need anything more." One preacher put it like this. He said, "To lay down prior human conditions to believing in God is not integrity, but it's actually simple unfaith. We can never talk to God Almighty like that, for he's never under our examination, but rather we are always under his. It is foolish to try to make God speechless with our questions, when one day it will be we who will stand before him, and it is we who will be the ones who are left speechless." Friends, be sure that is not you here today. Do ask questions if you're inquiring about the Christian faith. We have our Christianity Explained course, where people can ask whatever questions they like. But in doing so, make sure your motives are not like the Pharisees. Blind and cut off already to the reality of Jesus. For he said, if you seek, you will find. If you knock, the door will be open to you. So let's quickly finish off. We've had the hungry fed, the Pharisees rebuffed, and finally, verses 14 to 21, the disciples are warned. Now you may have heard the story of the man who went to the bank and said that he wanted some money. The teller asked him to make out a check, but the man refused to do so. The teller said to him, if you won't sign a check, I cannot give you any money. So the man left and promptly went across the street to another bank where exactly the same conversation took place. But after that exchange, the teller reached across his counter, took the man by the ears and banged his head three times on the counter. At that point, the man calmly took out a pen and signed the check. He then returned to the first bank and said, they gave me money across the street. How did that happen? Said the teller. Because they explained it to me, answered the man. Now it seems that Jesus is doing this sort of explaining to his disciples in these verses, verses 14 to 21. There they are, back in the boat, heading across the lake, when they realise that they've forgotten to do what you ought never to do when you're on a picnic, forget to bring the picnic lunch. Jesus hears them talking about them forgetting to bring enough bread, and he turns their conversation into a parable. Be careful, we read, Jesus warned them. Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod. Now, in the light of what Jesus has just been saying to the Pharisees, it seems that Jesus wants his disciples to make sure that they are not like the Pharisees. That is, having minds that are blind to the truth of his message. Beware of such evil, he says to them, for just like yeast, a small amount of such unbelief can quickly spread and cause you to fall away. It seems that in his estimation, his disciples were not too far away from such an attitude of unbelief, and thus he needs to warn them. And so just like that bank teller in the story, Jesus bangs their head with a series of questions to try to awaken their dull minds. Why are you talking about bread? He says. Bang. Do you not still see and understand? Bang. Are your hearts hardened? Bang. Do you have eyes but fail to see and ears but fail to hear? Don't you remember? Finally, bang. Now, for Jesus to ask his inner circle of disciples such questions would have been a most humiliating thing for them. For in effect, he's saying to them, are you going to be unbelievers forever? Are you going to be like those Pharisees, with eyes that fail to see and ears that fail to hear? Don't you remember that your eyes have just seen the mightiest works of God that has ever been seen, and that your ears have heard the most profound and authoritative teaching that has ever been heard, and still won't you get it? Don't you understand? Now, the problem with the disciples was not that they were particularly dull people, nor that they were hardened to Jesus as a person or a friend, but simply this: their hearts had become hard because of over-familiarity. They'd heard the message, they'd seen the miracles, but because they had not reflected upon it, nor acted upon it, they had become progressively dull to it. Now, as we'll see over the next few weeks, this chapter, chapter 8 of Mark, is the hinge chapter of the gospel. For as we'll see in a few weeks' time, as a result of this challenge, this repeated banging of their heads with his questions, the disciples finally come to see who Jesus is, and they come to confess him as their Lord and Messiah. But at this point, the challenge is still before them. And surely it's still before us as well. For isn't it too easy for us who come here week by week to be dulled into a sense of over-familiarity with Jesus? If we hear the message week by week, but we fail to reflect upon it, act upon it, if we put aside Jesus' challenge for us to live lives that are radically different in the world, if we fail to be the people of compassion towards the lost that Jesus was, then like the disciples, our hearts are in real danger of being hardened. For like them, it's a case of use it or lose it. Matthew 13, verse 12 says this: whoever has will be given more, and they will have it in abundance. Whoever does not have, even what they have will be taken away from them. We read before those chilling words in verse 13 of Mark 8, when the Pharisees confronted Jesus, we read, then Jesus left them. Now we know he did so geographically, but I think Mark wants us to know that he did so spiritually. And surely our prayer tonight might be that that would never be the case with us. For may we tonight be like the disciples in the next chapter, people who heed the warning of Jesus and open our eyes to who Jesus is, placing ourselves once again in his trust day by day. Friends, let's bow our heads and pray. Jesus says to us, do you still not understand? Maybe you're someone here tonight who has wanted more evidence, but perhaps you actually have all the evidence you need, and it's time tonight for decisive action. Will God leave you to your unbelief, or will you turn to him? Have mercy upon us, Lord Christ. Grant that no hearts in our church tonight may be so hardened towards you that your words and works of infinite love and grace may fall upon us and yet not be received. Help us all this evening receive your word with affection and great joy. And this we ask for the sake of Jesus our Lord, the bread of life for the whole world. Amen.